What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If that's you and you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we would love to talk with you this Thursday afternoon. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, 833-288-3986. What does the Catholic faith actually teach? Not what somebody says it teaches. What does it actually teach? That's why we're here. If you're listening to us outside of North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can always shoot us an email as well. ctc@ewtn.com, the address, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles is our producer, Ace McKay handling screening chores today. And we also have Rich Jesse on social media. Rich will be glad to forward your question if you're watching us on YouTube and you put your question in the comments box. Just put it right there. Rich will see it. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio. Love to answer your question today's program. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you?
Did I interrupt you mid-sip there? I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'm used to it.
You know, this is going to be a little bit of a challenge for some of our team here on the program. Today was our EWTN annual Thanksgiving luncheon. So it was like everybody who works here at the network, it's been, you know, turkey, ham, all the trimmings. So it was a wonderful lunch. And I must say, you know, the Bee Gees had Staying Alive, Staying Alive.
Mm-hmm.
For Pedro and I, it is Staying Awake, Staying Awake.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
But we can do it.
If you need to excuse yourself and go burp or something,
right. You have no idea how appreciative I am of that. Here's a question that came in yesterday from Justin watching us on YouTube. We couldn't get to his question yesterday, and I promised that we would tackle it today. Here's what Justin says. If having feelings is something that cannot be said of God, so what does the wrath of God mean?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So anytime you see in sacred scripture ascribing emotion or some other anthropomorphic human quality to God, So the way a Catholic would understand that is that, first of all, this is figurative language. It's not a literal predication of God. And, you know, wrath implies enmity or sort of the opposite of reconciliation, right? If you're under somebody's wrath in a human relationship, it means it's not going well between the two of you, right?
Right.
And since God is unchanging and He's the unchanging source of all goodness, it is possible to be out of whack, as it were, to not be reconciled to that, to not be participating in that goodness. And since it's not like if my UPS delivery man gets mad at me.
Yes.
Like, I'm not going to feel the lack. it's not like I'm going to sit up at night really anxious that the UPS or Julia doesn't like me. But what if I'm out of whack? What if I'm not in union or in participation with, the very source of light, the very source of truth, goodness, and beauty? Well, I'm going to suffer, and I'll feel that as a loss in my soul. I might not recognize it for what it is, but there's going to be something amiss. You know, St. Paul writes about this in Romans 7 when he talks about his own state of wretchedness because he lived at conflict with himself. Like he had this understanding of the good and the true and the beautiful, but he couldn't live it, and that made him wretched. And so one could quite reasonably experience that from a human point of view as if that were, wrath. Right, the way I would feel if some beloved human rejected me would feel horrible, and I'd feel alienated and lost and alone. If I'm alienated and lost from God, I might be able to, in an analogous way, in a figurative way, describe that as wrath. But the solution isn't to change God's mind, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's to change my orientation towards the good, true, and beautiful, and to get rid of whatever the impediments are that are causing that disruption in the relationship.
Justin, thanks for listening to us on YouTube. Here's the other question that came in on YouTube that we couldn't get to yesterday. This one from Teresa. How can I help a Buddhist student of mine who has expressed an interest in converting to Christianity, but is more interested in Protestantism than Catholicism?
Thanks. So, you know, this is a tough question because I don't know much at all about the student other than the fact that they're a Buddhist.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, some of the things that I would want to find out. Well, first of all, is this person a Western Buddhist? Who practices a kind of, the sort of neo-modernist Buddhism that's so popular, you know, the Hollywood Buddhism, as it were?
Yeah.
Or are we talking about someone that's from a traditional Buddhist culture like Sri Lanka or Thailand, who has a much more, devotional
Thoughtful, maybe?
No. So the way I would characterize the difference, modern sort of neo-modernist Buddhism in the West has a particular ideology that it's evolved that sees itself as, you know, kind of very progressive and very modern and very up on science. And it's really into, you know, certain forms of meditation, and it's not very dogmatic about distinctions within the Buddhist tradition. If you were to go to Sri Lanka or Thailand or Burma or any of these traditional Buddhist countries, you would find that the layman's experience of Buddhism is entirely different, and it's almost wholly taken up with questions of karma, of ritual behavior, the veneration of Buddhist relics.
More of a traditional.
Absolutely. And very little emphasis on texts or philosophy or science or any of the things that are sort of taken up in the mindset of the modern Western Buddhists. So they're really coming, two different religions really, and they're coming from two very different places. They use some of the same vocabulary, but very different conceptions of what it means to be a Buddhist. I don't know Buddhist is like a really big descriptor. I don't know what we're talking about here. I also don't know if this person's interest is more devotional, more philosophical. And all of that would come into play in how I communicated with them. So, you know, to a certain kind of Buddhist, I would want to introduce them to the Catholic philosophical tradition and to the Catholic spiritual tradition, right?
Okay.
But that's gonna land with some people better than others, and I just don't know enough about the context.
Understood. Teresa, thanks so much for watching us on YouTube. In a moment, we're going to talk with John in Newford, Georgia. A couple lines open for you as well, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. You know, EWTN offers a variety of prayer for all of your spiritual needs. You can find these wonderful prayers at EWTN.com/pray. And I ask you, what other network does that? EWTN.com/pray. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We're going to begin today with John in Newford, Georgia, listening on The Great Quest, AM 1160. Hello, John. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, how's it going?
Very well. What's your question today?
So I'm just calling in just to get some basic knowledge from y'all. I'm coming from a past where my mom was a non-denominational Christian.
Uh-huh.
My father, you know, his parents were more of the Catholicism and everything, and that's what, you know, caught my ear listening to y'all show. I recently, over the last, you know, 2 years, I've been with this one girl that I've been, you know, really serious about and everything, and she claims, you know, to be more of the atheist. And I don't know, you know, I do all my research that I can, but it, you know, at times it's playing with my heartstrings because it, you know, I don't like, that's really far from where I've, you know, grown up, you know, and I don't want to be let off the beaten path. So I go around and I, you know, try to pick up, you know, where I'm comfortable on finding, you know, education on, you know, where me and her can reside.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate the question. Thank you so much. So, you know, I definitely think that your intuition that this could be a problem, I think that intuition is correct. And, you know, if you're getting serious with this girl and maybe even thinking about marriage, you know, for starters, it's probable that you and she may have very different ideas about even what marriage is and what its purpose is and what the end goal is in marriage. And, you know, in marriage, at least in the Catholic understanding, is followed by the desire for children and active steps to attempt to conceive children. And then that raises a whole nother set of issues, which is how are you going to raise your kids with respect to God, religion, and the moral life. And so, you know, the possibility for conflict down the road is very high, and conflict about things that are really fundamental to your identity as human beings, as a couple, and as a family. And, you know, one thing, I'm 54 years old now. I have five children, a couple of grandkids, and so I speak from experience. You know, if you think you've had a few, like, disagreements now, boy, you ain't seen nothing until kids come on the scene. Like, and everybody will tell you, when children arrive, it's one thing to argue about where you're going to put your dirty socks, right? It's another thing to argue about where you're going to put your kids in school, what you're going to teach your kids about the meaning of life, and the stakes are so much higher than they are with dirty socks, that you don't want to yield. You know, if you have a very strong conviction about the meaning of life and the moral life and destiny, that's not something you want to. You're not gonna compromise on that with respect to your children. And two people who are unwilling to compromise on a fundamental moral issue is a recipe for difficulty. So I definitely think that's something you need to consider moving forward. Do I want to move forward if we have irreconcilable visions of the good life? You know, from a Catholic point of view, and I already alluded to this, marriage is a very specific kind of institution. In the modern world, a lot of people think of marriage as, well, you know, here are two people that are attracted to one another and might be sexually attracted to each other and maybe other kinds of attraction. We enjoy being together and, you know, we can partner together to enjoy one another and to companion with one another. And we hope it works out. If it doesn't work out, you know, well, we gave it a good try. That's not the Catholic view of marriage at all. Catholic view of marriage is that procreation, children, having babies, is really, really fundamental to society. That you have to replenish society to have a society. And so there is a specific institution that's critical for the maintenance of civilization that has been delegated the task by nature, like not by men, not by law, but just by nature, of replenishing society. And that institution is called the family or marriage. And so the decision to marry is the decision to enter into a kind of institution that you didn't create, that you can't create, that flows from the nature of the human person as such, from the fact that men and women are male and female, and they procreate in that way, that you are yielding yourself to that reality, not for your own sake or pleasure or convenience, but to create a civilization, a society, beginning the very small society of the family and ultimately contributing to the greater good of the whole, and you're willing to subsume your own personal interests under that goal. And so, you know, it's like the good of your spouse, the good of your children becomes more important to you than yourself. And so the option, well, you know, we gave it a good try and it didn't work out, so we're going to do something else, that ceases to be an option to you, right? Because all of a sudden these children are the most important thing in the world to you. And you'll give your life, you'll give your comfort, you'll give your sexual preferences, whatever it might be. Those go out the window in comparison to the transcendent dignity of the child in the life of the family. You know, I remember when I was in graduate school, I knew a man who was a married fellow with kids, and this was early days for this kind of movement. And he decided, you know, I'm tired of being a man. I think I'll go have a sex change operation and I'll become a woman, and I'll leave my wife and I'll leave my kids and I'll go off and start a new life because that's what floats my boat. and the family felt naturally quite abandoned. Well, that's kind of an extreme case, but lots more people have, you know, they get to middle age and they say, well, I'm tired of this wife, I'm tired of these kids, I want another version. So I'm going to sign up for the, you know, marriage 2.0 and family 2.0, and they, you know, leave the first one behind because it's all about me. It's all about what pleases me. It's my sexual preferences have changed, or my sexual identity has changed, or my circumstances have changed, and, you know, I'm no longer interested or committed to that other institution. From the Catholic point of view, that's a non-starter. You know, okay, your interests have changed, your pleasures have changed. Whoever said it was about you or your interests?
Yeah.
Right? And so there's a fundamental moral commitment that calls for self-sacrifice at the root of the relationship that's grounded in your faith in God, the dignity of the human person, the dignity of the family, the dignity of the sexual union. All these things come into play in a massive way, in a tremendously important way in the union of marriage. You may not share all those beliefs, but there are some things for you to think about.
Think about, pray about. John, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yes, sir. I appreciate y'all's time. Thank you so much.
We appreciate you listening to The Quest, and thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Let's go to Kenny now in Walla Walla, Washington, listening on the great KHSS. Hello, Kenny. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I have a question. I lost a brother to cancer about 10 hours ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And we were always very close, very tight. I'm a practicing Catholic, my wife, my children. It's always been my understanding that when it comes time after a family member passes, that they're either buried, or if they're cremated, their ashes are put in an urn or a mausoleum, and that's burial. I have four nieces and nephews that decided they wanted to have my brother cremated, and they wanted to share his ashes, and one throw them in the wind on a trail, and another in a river, and another on the fireplace in their living room. And I asked him, I said, well, if he'd been buried in a casket, before putting him in the ground, would one of you each want a hand or a foot? Well, of course not. But I have a problem with, and they know I have a problem with them, with the ash thing, but am I wrong?
So Kenny, I have a question for you. First of all, I'm terribly sorry about your loss. My heart goes out to you on this. It really does. What was your brother a practicing Catholic?
No, he wasn't.
Okay. Do you have any indication at all that he would have wanted Catholic funeral rites?
No.
Okay.
No.
The reason I ask is that the canon law of the Catholic Church forbids this practice that your nieces and nephews want to pursue. This you know, dividing up of the body and scattering it in different locations, that is not allowed for Catholics to do. Was your brother a baptized Catholic who was not practicing?
No, he was baptized, but he's Protestant.
Okay, all right. Well, if he was never baptized as a Catholic, then Catholic canon law really has no say here. It doesn't have jurisdiction over non-Catholics, and so they wouldn't be violating church law because they're not subject to church law if the family wasn't Catholic, and so you don't have that to fall back on. You know, the reason the Catholic Church has this law is that the practice of scattering ashes would seem to proceed from a superstitious understanding of the relationship of the body to the next life. You know, the Catholic doctrine is that the body is raised like Christ's. It will be made like him. It will be raised from the dead as he's raised from the dead. And so we honor the bodies of the dead as we venerate Christ and his members. And the practice of scattering ashes, by contrast, comes from the Hindu belief or the Indian belief in the transmigration of souls. and the essential sort of insignificance of the body, or it might stem from a kind of New Age conviction that the consciousness kind of clings to the remains and could be diffused throughout the natural world, something like that. In either case, you're talking about a superstitious doctrine. And so the Catholic Church would say that's inappropriate. Now, you know, if I'm talking to a Hindu, I'm not going to stand between the Hindu and his burial rites. I may regard them as superstitious, but I respect that that's where he's coming from, and in his conscience he's doing the right thing, and I'm not going to stand between a man and his conscience. So, you know, I think you've taken the right approach with your nieces and nephews. It's one thing if they have a deeply settled religious conviction that this is what they are supposed to do. If that's the case, I think it's, you know, it's going to be harder to have a conversation with them, and I don't know that I would try. If this is more kind of a sentimental or romantic thing, like, isn't that quaint, then you might be able to have a conversation about whether that's really dignified or respectful to your brother's remains.
Kenny, again, we are very sorry for your loss, and thank you for calling, sir. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Daniel, listening to us in Dallas on the Great Guadalupe Network. Daniel, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, how you guys doing?
Hey, Daniel, what's going on today?
Hey, so I was just discussing with one of my Calvinistic friends. He believes in monergism, obviously.
Yep.
And when we were discussing eternal security, whenever I bring up the warning passages in scriptures or they talk about falling from grace, he told me that these are descriptive passages, meaning that these warnings are put in place to keep God's elect believing in him because he put his fear in their hearts. There's two verses I was wondering if you could explain to me. One is Jeremiah 32, verse 40, where it says that I will make with them an everlasting covenant, that I will not turn away from doing good to them, and I will put the fear of them in my heart that they will not turn from me. And Ezekiel 36, which says, I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. So he's saying that the fear causes them to stay till the end, and that proves that eternal security is true, and that's the only purpose for these warning passages.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, first of all, your friend's position on the interpretation of New Testament exhortations not to leave the path of grace, I think is strained, obviously, and he's bringing a theological conviction to bear on a text that does not lend itself naturally to that interpretation. He's really sort of just twisting them out of shape to make them fit the theory. Now, one could make the claim that that you have to do that one way or another. Like, you either have to twist the Old Testament to fit the New, or you have to twist the New Testament to fit the Old. And I would actually agree with that, okay? Because when I look at the example of Christ, or the example of St. Paul, or any of the gospel writers, when they quote the Old Testament, sometimes you scratch your head and go, really? Is that really what it says? And you know, you may have heard me say this before. I think my favorite example of that is when the Pharisees ask Jesus if it's lawful for a man to divorce his wife, and Jesus says no. And they say, well, Moses said otherwise. Now, you go look it up in Deuteronomy. Moses did say otherwise. And they say, well, how can that be, Christ? Hey, Jesus. And he says, well, Moses put those things in there because of the hardness of your heart, but it wasn't like that from the beginning. And now go back and read the text in context. There's nothing in there about Moses making a concession to hardness of heart. The book of Deuteronomy just says, thus saith the Lord. So Christ has really brought a hermeneutical principle to bear in the Old Testament that's not borne out by the text itself. Now, hold that thought. I want to come back on the other side of the break.
Sit tight, Daniel. We'll continue right after the break, and we'll also talk with Sharon in Omaha. Hopefully, you as well at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. For Call to Communion, do stay with us. Hey, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Let's talk about that here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. A couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 3986. Before the break, we were talking with Daniel in Dallas. He called in with a question about salvation security.
Yeah, so it was specifically about the interpretation of two Old Testament passages where God promises to put his spirit in the elect and calls them to fear him so that he will not turn away. And the first question I wanted to raise was, what's the proper hermeneutic for understanding the Old Testament? Do we want to make Old Testament texts the rule by which we interpret the New? And I suggest that that's not what Christ did, not what St. Paul did. Secondly, let's take, for the sake of argument, your friend's contention that Jeremiah 32 is just the stuff, and we got to deal with that text as it stated. Is it a text about the Calvinist doctrine of eternal security? No. If you would take it literally, which is what he's suggesting you should do, then you have to read it about as a passage about the defeat of the Babylonians and the resettlement of the exile in the Promised Land. Because that's exactly what he talks about. He says, you know, once more fields will be bought in this land of which you say it's a desolate waste, right? Fields will be bought for silver and deeds will be signed, sealed, and witnessed in the territory of Benjamin and the villages around Jerusalem, in the towns of Judah, and in the towns of the hill country of the western foothills of the Negev. Now, let me ask you a question. Does your buddy live in the Negev? No, probably not.
No.
Therefore, if he's going to be overly fundamentalist and literalistic about this text, it does not apply to him. Right? It would apply to the return of the exiles from Babylon, right? If you're really going to push that thing that far. Secondly, you remember that passage in Exodus chapter 32 when God says to Moses, whoever sins against me, after he's just promised to be a father to Israel and never abandon them, he turns around and says, but if anyone sins against me, I will blot him out of my book. He's getting blotted out, bud, if he sins against me. So I'm going to be a father and be faithful to them and all that. However, if you sin against me, out you go. Blot, blot, blot.
Wow.
All right. Now, hold that thought in mind. Skip with me over to Revelation chapter 3, verse 5. And Revelation 3, he who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot his name out from the book. Clearly an allusion to Exodus 32. But in the New Testament, the eternal security, the promised land to which the promise applies, right? The destiny of the elect is in the eschaton when Christ has returned and vindicated his elect, right? But in a media res, in the midst of things, in the present age, we have to cooperate with the work of grace. And that's clearly the purpose of the admonitions of the New Testament. And St. Peter says in 2 Peter 2, he speaks about those who have been brought into the kingdom of God through baptism and faith and the sacraments, and yet have turned back to sin. And he says it's better for them never to have entered the way of righteousness. They entered the way of righteousness and then turned back. Or, you know, Hebrews talking about those who've tasted the heavenly gift and so forth. Now, you know, practically speaking, so that's all exegetical.
Right? Okay, all right.
Practically speaking, the Calvinist business of eternal security is a little bit dicier than you might think, because Calvin himself and all of his followers recognize that there is such a thing empirically as apostasy. There are people who are subjectively persuaded that they have faith and who give all the appearances of having faith and conversion, and yet who apostatize and they leave the faith and they go back into wayward living. And so traditionally, the way the Reformed tradition has handled that reality is to say, well, there's two kinds of faith. There's real faith, and then there's spurious faith. That is to say, something that has only the appearance of faith. And so if someone apostatizes, well, they must not have really been saved to begin with. They must not have really had faith to begin with. Well, so what they had was some kind of simulacrum of faith, but not the real McCoy. Well, that raises, from a subjective point of view, an intolerable difficulty. How do I know which one I have?
Yeah.
How do I know that I have the real stuff, or do I have the simulacrum? And, of course, Puritanism wrestled with this question mightily. How do I know I'm one of the ones in whom faith really took hold and that I don't have the fake faith? And so you have someone like Thomas Hooker on the preparationist side, you know, to one extreme, who's just a radical moralist. I mean, he puts any 15th century Catholic nominalist to shame, right, with the degree of moral rigor that he's advocating. all the way to Ann Hutchinson and the liberals on the left, who were total antinomians, who basically said, you know, run out and sin boldly, it doesn't matter what you do, right? And every shade in between of Puritanism, trying to figure out how to thread that needle, you know, that where I can have infallible certainty of my election, which must include having infallible certainty that I have the real stuff kind of faith rather than the spurious kind, except then you apostatize and figure it out, oh, it must have been the spurious kind all along. The dilemma, the paradox, led a friend of mine to this conclusion. He said, in the Reformed tradition, the elect know for sure they're going to heaven, and I might be one of them. And my own subjective experience of the Reformed tradition bears that out, that you have this tendency to vacillate between one of two states, presumption or despair. Presumption meaning an unwarranted confidence in my salvation, or despair, an unwarranted doubt about my salvation, because the whole thing is predicated on the notion that salvation is something of which I can be subjectively certain right now, right? That I can know today what the outcome will be in the future. And that is not the way reality works. And when I became Catholic, I found the Catholic response to the problem of security so much more psychologically satisfying. And it struck me the first time I went into a confessional. Never been to confession before. Made my confession. And the priest said to me, God the Father of mercies has sent the Holy Spirit among us for the forgiveness of sins. Well, he did that in John chapter 20, right? Through the ministry of the church. Okay, now I'm thinking Matthew chapter 18.
Yes.
May he grant you pardon and peace, and I, that is the priest speaking, absolve you from your sins in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Now, as soon as I heard those words, and I saw in my mind, I could connect it to the upper room, I could connect it to the promise of Christ, I saw how the theology all fit together with the sacred scripture, and then I realized that, you know, the Reformed position is this, it's a syllogism. If you have real faith, then you will be saved eternally. I'm sure I have real faith because I can subjectively examine my own conscience. Therefore, I know I'll have faith eternally. That's the Reformed syllogism, basically. Right? And you coming up with, how do I know I have real faith? That's the problem. Here's the Catholic syllogism, right? Wherever grace is on offer, there forgiveness is available. Objectively, grace is on offer through the sacraments, especially the sacrament of reconciliation. That doesn't require any subjective determination on my part. Like, I don't have to gaze into the depths of my interior life and try to discern the signs of election or the evidences of real faith. All I have to do is believe objectively in the promise of Christ, right? So it's grounded in something outside of myself. Here's the priest in front of me. He has authority to forgive sins. He just said, my sins are forgiven. Oh, I guess they're forgiven. Like that, boom, there you go.
Yeah.
Now, Christ's continuing admonition, he who perseveres to the end will be saved, is accompanied by the promise, if you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have life. As long as I continue in the practice of the sacramental life, which of course presumes my continuing in the state of grace. I mean, and the priest is authorized to make that determination, like whether I'm really contrite or not. So there's an objective external evaluation of the state of my life and whether I'm worthy to receive the sacraments by the church, which is authorized to do this. Whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. The church forms the judgment. You're worthy to come to communion. That's a kind of a moral certainty that I'm in the state of grace. I've objectively received forgiveness through the sacraments. I purpose to maintain my fellowship with the church until the day I die. As long as I hang on to that life raft, then I'll persevere to the end and I'll be saved. Like that. That, to me, is so much more subjectively satisfying because it's based on objective criteria.
Sure, sure.
Right? And I realized I don't have to deal with this question of, do I have real faith, fake faith, all that's just irrelevant. All that what Newman called self-contemplation, all that introspection, all that navel-gazing is done away with. Perry Miller, the great historian of Puritanism, once said, Protestantism saved man from the treadmill of indulgences, but threw him on the iron couch of introspection, you know? And I found that to be very true.
And I bet you sleep a lot better, too.
I sleep like rot, but not because of this.
Oh, okay. Daniel, thank you so much for your question. We hope that is helpful for you there in Dallas. Call to Communion here on EWTN. As you know, we have some wonderful weekend programming cooked up for you, not just this weekend, every weekend. One of those great shows is radio, classic radio, and that's Family Theater, which we bring you every Sunday night at 11:30 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. This weekend, Roth Cameron starring in The Black Tulip, hosted and narrated by William Mundigan. Again, Family Theater, classic radio, always a great listen with a full orchestra, sound effects, a live audience. It aired back on the Mutual Network back in the day. Anyway, check it out Sunday night, 11:30 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. All right, let's go to Sharon now in Omaha, listening on the Great Spirit Catholic Radio. Hello, Sharon. What's on your mind today?
Yes, I became a widow last year of April at 51.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. I am now 52. And God has given me another man that I have fallen in love with, and we have been, you know, we've talked about marriage. So my question is, we're older, and I know when I married my first husband, we were to procreate and have children. So what is expected of us older people now? What's expected of us when we get married?
Great question. Great question. Really appreciate that. So, in a sense, it's the very same thing that's expected of two 20-year-olds. The Catholic Church does not expect 20-year-olds necessarily to be fertile, because some of them aren't, right?
Yeah.
What the Church expects is that you enter into the kind of relationship that would naturally be fulfilled in the bearing of children if such children come your way. And you take no steps to prevent the procreation of children, that when you engage in the marital act, it be with an openness to life, a life that's never guaranteed, a fertility, a fecundity that you don't control,
right,
that is up to God's providence. And that's the kind of relationship that you're aiming at. Now, let's say you enter into that kind of relationship and children never happen. But if you're in that kind of relationship, then there's a spiritual fecundity about your persons that makes you open and receptive to life as such. And that could be the life of nieces and nephews, the life of grandchildren, the life of godchildren, the life of the church, the life of the young. You see what I'm saying? Like that a married couple, as you know this from your previous marriage, I mean, they become a kind of light. And they bring a value to the community and to the common good that transcends each of them alone, right? And you make a determination to share that for the sake of the common good, primarily for the common good of your own family, but then that redounds outward in these concentric circles to the benefit of everybody. And then, of course, you always have that expectation, not one made expectation, that openness, mm-hmm. You know, maybe we have an Abraham and Sarah moment.
Could be.
It's not likely. Not likely.
Not likely.
But that's what we signed up for.
Sure.
Don't expect it, but that's our disposition. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It does. Yep. No, I appreciate it.
Fantastic.
I've been wondering.
Yep.
So, no, it's great. Thank you.
Appreciate your call, Sharon. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Tina now. Tina is in Newton Falls, Ohio, listening on the Great Living Bread Radio. Hi, Tina. What's on your mind today?
Yes. My daughter had a stillbirth a couple months ago, and the baby died about 15 weeks. They named him. He was cremated. They have him at home and plan to bury him when a family member passes and is buried. Friends have paid for mass intentions. Because he died before he was born, he wasn't able to be baptized, although he was blessed. Where does original sin come into this?
Yes, thank you so much. So, and I'm terribly sorry about your loss, really. I'm very sorry. The Catechism of the Catholic Church says that original sin is sin by analogy only, that it is not actual sin, and so that it does not imply personal guilt. And it has always been the position of the Catholic Church that infants and the stillborn bear no personal guilt for which they would have to make atonement or receive forgiveness. Mm. Now, there was a theory that emerged in the Middle Ages that was never Catholic dogma, but it went like this. Well, because infants have no personal guilt, they will not go to hell. but because they didn't receive the grace of baptism, they can't go to heaven. And so theologians made up the category of limbo as a, you know, it wasn't the beatific vision, which requires grace. It was a place of natural happiness. You know, think of it like an eternity in a Caribbean golf resort or something, you know, but not the beatific vision,
okay,
where the souls of unbaptized infants would go. Now, that opinion, it was just a theological opinion, but it held sway for a long time. Modern Catholic teaching and the modern church and the opinion of popes and so forth has been against the existence of purgatory and towards a presumption of God's mercy and grace and a kind of, well, we have no scriptural promise. We have every reason to presume upon God's mercy. And so from an attitudinal point of view, like, I would assume the salvation of those souls definitely would rule out, you know, perdition. And yet, to have, you know, masses said and prayers said for such souls is also not inappropriate. And, you know, that's kind of inconsistent. But the long and the short of it is God is merciful. These children are innocent. God is also just. He doesn't condemn those who don't need condemning. And so there's no reason to be anything other than hopeful about their eternal destiny.
Tina, thank you so much for your call. Again, we extend our condolences for your loss. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Jack is watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Jack says, can you please explain the difference between the Protestant and Catholic view of original sin and the Orthodox view of ancestral sin?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, you know, we're just touching on this a little bit when we talked about original sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Orthodox traditionally strongly resist the doctrine of original sin. They don't like it. They think it's Augustinian, which it is, of course. St. Augustine's the one that really put it on the map in Catholic theology. But they recognize that something happened in the fall of Adam that implicates the rest of us. And typically, in the Orthodox view, we're born into an existential condition where we're weak, we're prone to sin, we're subject to sickness and death, and all of these are seen to be the result of Adam's fall. But they don't necessarily imply personal guilt on the individual's fault, and so to speak of sin here would be inappropriate. Maybe like the fruit of sin, the result of sin, of Adam's sin, but not our sin. And that, you know, to be contrasted with, you know, what they would take to be a Latin doctrine of transmuted guilt. Now, I just got finished saying that in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it teaches that original sin is not personal guilt, that the language of sin is by analogy only, and that we're really talking about coming into the world with the lack of sanctifying grace and with the effects of Adam's fault, which are, you know, the concupiscence of soul and immoderate attachment to bodily pleasures, to the, you know, the ignorance, moral weakness, and so forth. And so I think from that point of view, there's not as much distance between the Orthodox and the Latin Catholic view as might be thought, and that it is more semantic than otherwise. Now, there were earlier periods of the Church's history where some pushed the idea of inherited guilt, and so there's some basis for the Orthodox to get their feathers ruffled about that. But that's not the teaching of the Catholic faith. There have been Catholic theologians that have talked that way, but the official teaching of the Catholic Church, I think, is a lot closer to the Orthodox doctrine. Now, you run into a similar problem when you flip it around and talk about the cure, in that Catholics have the Catholic doctrine of sanctifying grace has some differences to the Orthodox doctrine of grace. But you didn't ask that question. But it, you know, it's sort of the parallel to original sin. You can talk about that too.
Yeah, and there you go, Jack. Thanks so much for watching us this afternoon on YouTube. Call to Communion here on EWTN. This email from Tina: what did Lucifer and the fallen angels do? What did they do to get sent to hell?
We don't know. We do not know. Now, theologians have speculated that it may have been the sin of pride.
Mm.
One thing we do know is that it couldn't have been any bodily concupiscence because they didn't have bodies. Right? So,
yeah.
So, you know, they didn't... you know, they didn't go have a kegger or something, you know. They didn't have a wild Saturday night.
Yeah.
So it had to be a spiritual sin, and there are sins that are purely spiritual. Sure. And so pride would seem like a good contender. And, you know, there's a passage in Ezekiel that's allegorically treated to be about Lucifer that does suggest that, you know, it's about an ancient Near Eastern king. He wants to set himself up in glory over that of God. And you know, if you apply that to the case of Lucifer, then you would say, okay, pride is the thing. But basically, we don't know. They failed some test. The righteous angels succeeded it, and therefore were confirmed in grace, and the fallen angels were not confirmed in grace.
All right. And Tina, thanks so much for your email. Here's one we received from Andrew. What is the meaning of this? These signs will accompany those who believe. Surely in current times, it is viewed as dangerous for a lay believer to attempt an exorcism, and after all, not even the Pope could drink poison and survive. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks. So that the question of miracles as a motive of credibility is a point of Catholic dogma. And the Church has always held that there are miracles within the life of the Church,
mm-hmm.
In particular in association with the lives of the saints, that these can be demonstrated and that they are one of the motives of credibility in the Catholic faith. And the position that there are no contemporary miracles, a doctrine known as cessationism, flows from the Protestant Reformation, and it happened because the Reformers did no miracles. And so Catholic polemicists would throw in their face the charge, well, you know, you're advising a change of sacraments and of law and of theology that is so severe that surely if God wanted to take the Church in this direction, he would confirm your message with miracles. All right, buddy, put up or show up, where are your miracles? And the Reformers, Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and Cranmer, responded by saying, no, miracles were there to establish the Church, and they did their work. We're simply trying to return it to its pristine condition. And so the demand for miracles is illegitimate. In fact, God doesn't do miracles anymore. That was the Protestant response, position known as cessationism. And cessationism held sway in many circles, but it was never universally accepted in the Protestant world. It really came under attack in the 19th century. There was a healing movement and a prophecy movement in the 19th century that got cranking. And then, of course, modern Pentecostalism turned against that doctrine entirely. And you still find cessationists among Protestant fundamentalists and Reformed Christians. There's a great book on the topic by a Pentecostal theologian named John Ruthven, Ruthven. He did his doctoral dissertation on the cessationism of B.B. Warfield and the Princetonians.
Wow.
And I read that book years ago, and it was very helpful. But anyway, now I've forgotten the question.
Well,
I got off in geekdom there.
The meaning of these signs will accompany.
Oh yeah. So basically, the point is that the Catholic Church has always held that speaking in tongues and prophecies and miracles and healings and exorcisms accompany the life of the Church, but they do so in a way consistent with scriptural teaching, meaning they're not the gift that every individual Catholic has. Right.
Sure.
So exorcisms are restricted to those who've been delegated to that ministry. You know, prophecies and healings and so forth belong to those to whom the charism have been given. But if you read the lives of the saints, they're replete with miracles, and in fact, required for canonization. Post-mortem miracles are required for canonization.
There you go. Andrew, thanks so much for your email. We'll close with this one from Sandra. How can a person love all people equally, or love my neighbor as myself? How does God expect one to love a person who has hurt you or even continues to hurt you?
Yeah, see if I can do this in 1 minute. So you do not have to love abuse. You do not have to love injustice. Love means that you want the good for that person and you want to be in union with that person in the good, not just in any kind of union. So, you know, let's say someone's beating your head in and he says, I have a great idea. Let's have a party where I beat your head in. You don't have to agree to that party, right?
Good,
you don't have
good.
To be in union on that. And what's the good for that abuser? Well, to repent, to reform, to become virtuous. So loving that person means that you want for them what they genuinely need, which is a change of life. And being in union with them doesn't mean signing up for their abuse. It means wanting to be in union with them insofar as they are pursuing the good, the true, and the beautiful. Now, if they don't comply with that vision of the good life, you are under no obligation to stand there and let them take your head off.
Okay, you did it. Look at that. One minute. Here comes the music. Perfect. Dr. David Andrews, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
We do this program Monday through Friday here on EWTN at 2 p.m. Eastern. Check us out anytime you wish by going to our Podcast Central section of EWTN.com. Here's how you get there. Go to EWTN.com, look for the radio box, and then once you've clicked on that, that's going to take you to the radio homepage. Then just look for the words Podcast Central. Now with 100 podcasts for you to choose from, not only the programs like this one and other ones that we do, like Open Line coming up next on most of these stations, but also programs, you know, podcasts from our partners all over the world. So do check out Podcast Central when you can. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Thanks for joining us. Look forward to our next visit tomorrow on the Friday edition of Call to Communion. We'll see you then. God bless.